Hi, everyone. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and that was the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band with their take on the classic Joni Mitchell tune, Both Sides Now, from Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Remember that album? Next month, John McEwen of the Dirt Band visits the Wheeler Opera House to commemorate that seminal album. And here with us today to talk about that and a few other things too is the head honcho of Mountain Groove Productions, Josh Berman. Hi, Josh.
How are you, Luke?
Good, thanks. Are you a honcho?
I'm not a honcho.
Yeah?
I could be a honcho. One day I'll be a honcho.
Do you want to be?
it's not something I've given thought to yet.
Yeah, what do you want to be?
Will give it thought.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
A grown up, maybe. that's something I strive to be, is just a grown up, just to be a mature individual. I think that's something that I just need to strive for. That's going to be my first thing as I strive to be an adult.
I think maturity might be a little overrated, my friend. Don't you?
I do think so. I feel mature, but not mature.
Now that I've boxed you into a corner, I'm going to give you a chance to get out of that corner.
Thank you.
Tell us about Will the Circle Be Unbroken and John McEwen's visit to the Wheeler.
It's going to be great. It's going to be John McEwen and friends. So it'll be a four or five piece band. And, we still don't know who that band will be. John is still choosing who he's bringing with him. I have a feeling it's going to be the original accordion player from Nitty Gritty. It might be some other Dirt Band members. It will be a multimedia show, which will be a little bit different. So while he'll be telling you, he'll be playing tunes with the band, but he'll also be telling you stories about how the Dirt Band came up, the Carter family, this particular album, when it was made. There'll be video while he's talking, so he could refer to the old days, back in the day of the Circle being unbroken. So I think it's going to be super interesting. Of course, we'd love to celebrate it. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, it is their 50-year anniversary, and there's so much to be celebrated for them. But I think this will be really special. John will have an opportunity to pick hand-picked musicians. Bobby Mason will open, and Bobby Mason and John do have history, and of course Bobby Mason has history with the Dirt Band. So I think it's just going to be a really special evening. We'll see video, we'll hear stories, we'll hear great music. It's just going to be dynamic.
Is that going to be video from the actual sessions?
I think so, yes.
Oh, how about that?
Yes.
Now, yes. Those sessions happened in 1971, and I discovered that Will the Circle Be Unbroken, 45 years later, is still a bestseller on Amazon. Why do you think that is?
Because there's some music, like you were playing Both Sides Now, Joni Mitchell. There's some music that is timeless. That if it came out today, it would be just as strong as it came out 45 years ago. Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, these artists have that their music is just completely timeless. And I think that some of those things, some of these songs that were written then are pertinent now. To our lives and things that are happening, especially more now than ever.
Well, I know that was one of the first attempts to bring together the old guard of bluegrass with the new. It was a kind of a clash of cultures. Obviously, it wasn't a clash. It was a seamless melding.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. I that's to be celebrated. And that's to be celebrated, and that's what this evening will be about. An opportunity to really celebrate that the making of this album, the history of the Dirt Band, these guys are still 50 years later, touring, playing together, still playing the same music, and also coming out with new music. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, John McEwen has a new album that is top of the Americana billboard. And if I'm not mistaken, I think there's some or a re-release of a Nitty Gritty that's also top billboard.
How about that? Well, yeah, John's new CD called Made in Brooklyn, and I understand he's going to play a little bit of that on at this show too. And I should mention to our listeners that we've already arranged to have John McEwen stop by KD&K on his way to the Wheeler with his band, and they're going to play that afternoon before they hit Aspen. So that's pretty
fantastic.
Cool.
That's so fantastic.
Well, you know, I would say along with Old and In the Way, Will the Circle Be Unbroken kind of introduced a lot of people like you and me, Josh, to a music that we wouldn't have otherwise known about.
Right. That's a brilliant point, Luke. I mean, that is completely correct. If it wasn't for Old and In the Way, that was my introduction to bluegrass. And that's what got me to a my first bluegrass festival, and never stopped going ever since then. Circle being unbroken too has introduced the same to a lot of people as well. I think that's a brilliant point.
Yeah. Well, speaking of bluegrass, is there any music about Palisade? Is there any news about Palisade we should know about?
We haven't made anything public.
Okay.
So the everything is pretty much wrapped up.
Nice.
I would love to tease a little something right now, maybe. I'm trying to think of something smart that I could say that I could tease. I'll throw this out there. One of our bands on Sunday, on June 11th, just won the IBMA Band of the Year Award.
Nice.
And I will leave it at that for your listeners to figure that out.
Now, there's people all over the valley going on Google right now.
Yeah.
So you've got another show coming to the Wheeler, too, this winter that you're involved with. Tell us about the Rodney Crowell Trio.
So Rodney Crowell Trio, I am a huge Rodney Crowell fan. And for as long as I've been presenting shows, he's just always been on my list. And for whatever reason, it just never came to fruition. And there were many times that I thought it was confirmed, and it, for whatever reason, didn't. And so I've always stayed on him and to present him at the Wheeler. It's just something I've been wanting to do for literally 20 years.
Nice.
And it just fell right into place this particular time. And he is coming out, coming out with a new album as he puts out more material than most artists.
Yes,
over the last 40 years. I mean, it's amazing how much music he puts out. I think he is, people that know him, and I think we kind of touched on this when we spoke about it, that people that know him are huge fans. He has written for a lot of people. I mean, back in the day, of course, made great music, with Roseanne Cash, I mean, Lou Harris, he wrote for a lot of people. He's had a top billboard hit four decades. One hit every decade for four decades.
That's impressive.
I mean, that's just amazing.
Yes, it is.
And it's just something, there's something about him that kind of just touches me. I don't know, his voice, his writing, some songs even that he covers that he did not write, I think he does better than most. So I'm just a big, big fan, that's what I'm most looking forward to. I mean, there's so many people who I have seen over the years. I've never seen him live, always wanted to. And I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great show. He's going to be performing with his trio. He has new material, new album coming out. So I think it's going to be really a beautiful night and evening with. And I think it'll be fantastic. I'm looking forward to it.
Rodney Crowell, March 14th at the Wheeler, John McEwen, and the Will the Circle Be Unbroken concert happening January 19th. Can people get tickets to those shows already, Josh?
Yes. Aspen, both are on sale, and both actually sold quite well. AspenShowTickets.com, and you can always go, call 920-5770 or stop by the Wheeler anytime. One more thing I do want to bring up before we close out. I am doing also a concert for Stewie Oxenhorn. It's going to be called Concert for Stewie. February 4th tickets are not on sale yet, but will be on sale soon. And we have 20 local musicians that are participating. Brothers Keepers, the house band, and we're going to be performing Grateful Dead and Bob Dylan music only. And musicians will be invited on and off stage: Steve Postel, Bobby Mason, Suzanne Paris. The list goes on and on. I think that'll be really fun. So I'll once that goes on sale, I'll let you know. And but your listeners should just stay in the loop on that. And I think it'll be a really special evening.
That's at the Wheeler also?
At the Wheeler, February 4th.
February 4th. All right. Mark your calendars, folks. Josh Berman, thank you so much for joining us today. As always, you've got your fingers in some really great stuff.
Luke, I appreciate you having me so much.
Take care, okay?
Thank you.
It is coming right up on 420, and this is the Express Yourself show on KDNK. Stay tuned. We have more to come. Let's go out on this segment with another from Will the Circle Be Unbroken. Here is Sailing On to Hawaii. Circle Be Unbroken. That was Nitty Gritty Dirt Band Sailing On to Hawaii. And I'll bet John McEwen tells some great, great stories. So keep your eyes on that one. All right. It is time to continue with today's show. KDNK News intern Raleigh Burley caught up with the new director of the Glenwood Springs Historical Society, Bill Kite.
Welcome to KDNK Radio. This is Raleigh Burley, joined by Bill Kite, the new director of the Glenwood Springs Historical Society and Frontier Museum off Colorado Avenue. Good afternoon, Bill. Thank you for coming in and agreeing to interview with us here at the studio at KDNK Carbondale. I understand that you also have your own show here at KDNK?
I do. It's called For Land's Sake, and it's on the second Tuesday of every month.
Great. That's something to look forward to. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the Glenwood Springs Historical Society?
Well, I was on the board of directors back in probably about 1998, I believe, when I first got on the board, and been on it off and on since then, and as a board member, trying to preserve the living legacy of the community of Glenwood Springs and the Roaring Fork Valley. So that's a big, tall order, actually, and there's a lot that comes with that. So as a director, the thing I'm looking forward to the most is to try to establish a new place to show our fine photos that we have and some of our items that we could put on display, because we're really bursting out at the seams there, and we'd like to get a place where we'd be able to show our photographs and our artifacts in a bigger place, and then keep that building that's there at 1001 Colorado Avenue as a period piece house. Mm-hmm. most of our visitors are from out of town, and the people in the community make it about as far as the post office and never go that other extra block to, right. to come visit us. So if we were more in the core of the downtown area, then I think we'd be able to have more of a presence that would have more visitors.
So have you already been looking at potential sites?
I have. I'm working with a number of people. I'll just leave it at that for okay. now until things work out a little bit better. We're not in a big hurry, but at the same time, we would like to try to find a place as soon as possible. And we even looked at the library, which is owned by the city and has been vacant for a number of years, to do something similar to what's done here in Carbondale at the 3rd Street Center. But that requires a number of nonprofits to get together. It's a lot of moving parts on that, and I don't know if that's going to make it or not.
Okay. Well, what an exciting development to look forward to for the community. I'd like to ask a little more about your academic background. I understand you studied archaeology.
I did. You know, the professor that helped with a big project I did with the BLM and Forest Service called the Ute Trail Project, put it best as far as academic credentials are concerned and how I feel about them. He said, you know, we take a lot of money from people and then we give them their get out of here papers. So I've never really given a lot of credence to pieces of paper and degrees, but I do have a degree in anthropology from the University, Eastern New Mexico University. I spent a number of years at UNM, University of New Mexico. You know, really the experience I've had over the last 30 years right before I retired is really much more valuable than the time I spent in a classroom.
What were you studying specifically?
Well, I started in 1978 with the Bureau of Land Management in Socorro, New Mexico. And I did a number of things when I was in between appointments. I was a seasonal at that time. And I helped to record a lot of major Pueblo sites that hadn't been visited for a number of years, and none of them really recorded to modern standards along what's called the Rio Bajo, the middle province of the Rio Grande area. And the book was published later called Rio Bajo, and I think it was 1984. The prehistory and history of a Rio Grande province, and that was a lot of fun. I helped with the Chaco Roads Project, documenting the road system. That's a pretty amazing feature of the middle part of New Mexico. And I had hiked along the whole Jornada do Muerto with Michael Marshall, who we wanted to do that simply because it was an interesting piece of the Camino Real and the history of New Mexico and the relations between Mexico and Chihuahua City and Santa Fe. And that was quite a project. It taught me how to use what we call low sun angle photography, which is where you fly over an area when the sun's just coming up and it pops up any kind of features, linear features, like a road system. So, yeah, I've had a lot of experience that I think has prepared me for the things I'm doing now as a director of the museum.
For those of you who are joining us, my name is Raleigh Burley, and I'm here interviewing Bill Kite, the new director of the Glenwood Springs Historical Society and Frontier Museum. I would like to highlight a little bit of your research concerning the Ute who once inhabited these valleys. If you could just share with our listeners something about the customs or history that may intrigue.
Well, I, you know, would rather the Utes tell about their own history. That just hasn't happened yet. They haven't really written their own history, and there's a number of reasons for that. But my experience with them is they really don't need another spokesperson to talk about their history. I will mention that they originally in our area that we live in had probably 8 or 9 bands, depending on the expert you listen to as to which bands they were. And they didn't marry within the band, and so they had to find a mate outside the band in one of those other groups of people. They usually came together in the spring for the bear dance, and then in the summer during the hottest part of the summer for the sun dance. And so those were the two main spiritual functions that the Utes did. And of course, today they have a big presence both in southern Colorado and in Utah, where the inhabitants of this area were driven at forced march to Utah when they were driven out of Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to visit the reservation where they now live in Utah?
I have. There was an elder that I worked closely with who passed away a few years ago, Clifford Duncan, and he and I worked together, had the privilege of working with him and also with Kenny Frost of the Southern Ute Tribe, you know, and Terry Knight of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe. There are three tribes today. When we divided and conquered the Ute Nation like we did most indigenous groups in North America and the United States, we taught them how to have the kind of government we have. And so they have a tribal council or a business committee that makes major decisions that you appear before if you really want to work with the tribes at all. But I think most people need a broader understanding to really have any clue as to what it's like to be an indigenous person in the United States. And I recommend a book that's called In the Courts of the Conqueror, and it's The 10 Worst Indian Law Cases Ever Decided by Walter Echohawk, who is a justice in the Supreme Court of the Pawnee Indian Nation. And I think once you read that book, you might understand a little bit better about treaties, broken treaties, and the on-again, off-again relationship of sovereign nations with the Supreme Court.
Right. And I understand that what made the Ute very special was their nomadic customs. They would travel up and down these valleys that we now inhabit. Do you feel that they've retained a lot of their culture and their traditions, their stories, despite now being, you know, confined to one place and no longer living on the road?
Well, you know, they're free to go wherever they want. So there are a lot of people that don't live on the reservation. The reservation was really divided up at various points, allowing people that aren't Ute to settle in their reservation. So you get what's called a checkerboard effect on the reservation today. And really, you know, it's if you can imagine having a treaty that tells you what you can't do, which is what a treaty really does. It reserves the right to do certain things, and that hence the word reservation and the reserve rights of a treaty. But most of the treaties that were signed by the Utes early on just kept really dividing up their country a little bit more and a little bit more each time. So it really is a history of relationships that were at the best tenuous and were broken a number of times through treaties and agreements. You have to piece it together by reading different accounts, again, because at this point in history, the Utes themselves haven't written that history, and I'd like to see that done.
And, of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline is spurring a lot of passionate feelings across the country. A lot of young people, old people, all kinds of people are identifying with this cause, maybe going back and reading books of old treaties. What do you think of this general trend?
Well, I think it, you know, comes and goes. There's been attention to Native Americans, indigenous people, off and on throughout the time that I've been in anthropology, and it sort of becomes a fad for a while, and then it fades away. I think that just shows that people, again, don't understand really what's at stake here with a sovereign nation and how our relationship with a sovereign nation is supposed to be. I worked when I was the Heritage Resource Manager for the Forest Service until May of this year in that special government-to-government relationship of one sovereign nation, the United States, with another sovereign nation. And a lot of people don't understand that sovereign concept.
And could you explain it for those who maybe don't understand?
Well, it's if you really want to have the proper relations with an indigenous tribe, Utes included, then you appear before their tribal council as a government representative in what's called a government-to-government relationship. And if you can imagine an ambassador from another country coming over here that has relationships with the United States, then they're going to have the red carpet rolled out. They're going to have special treatment. And yet we don't really do that for tribes, though we should in that relationship certainly honor treaties that have gone before and honor that relationship in a special way, because it is a special relationship. A lot of people don't understand that relationship with a sovereign nation. So it's complicated. It takes a lot of hard work. I tell people if they want to work with tribes, they need to bring their lunch, because they're going to be in it for a long time. And simply because You're being watched to make sure that you're honest, that you're dealing above board, and that your word can be trusted, and that you will keep your word. So I was able for over 20 years to work with the Ute tribes in what's called the Ute Trail Project, and I'm really proud of that that project, because it helped to find a lot of the ancient sites that the Ute people were responsible for living in, and sacred sites especially, and that was something that I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to do.
And for anybody who maybe wants to get involved with the Indigenous histories, any recommendations to get them started?
Well, like I said, you know, the best thing is, since there's not a real book written by the Ute people, then is to visit the reservation and find out what's going on that way. You know, you become friends with people in relationships because you have common interest. And rather than it being a fad, a common interest would be, for instance, in the pipeline that's being demonstrated against, because it's not just limited to one tribe or even to the United States. There are a lot of Indigenous people from all over the world that this has really struck a special chord with them. And in them coming here to help with that protest says a lot about the fact that, you know, we don't have the kind of relationship we generally should with Native tribes or with Indigenous peoples, despite the UNN's Declaration of Indigenous Rights that came out a few years ago. So we're still, I think, at a period in history where there's a lot that could be done to improve those relationships, and it happens on a one-to-one basis. So that's all I can say at this point.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Bill Kite. My name is Raleigh Burley. This was our interview with Bill Kite, the new director of the Glenwood Historical Society, and you're listening to KDNK.
Thank you, Raleigh. Let's finish today's show with one from the archives. No one can accuse Rhiannon Giddens of the Carolina Chocolate Drops of not caring about what she does. Rhiannon, besides being talented and beautiful, is the most mission-driven musician I've ever talked to. She joined Express Yourself in early spring of 2013, prior to her local gig. Well, all the way from Boston, Massachusetts, with a banjo on her knee, a fiddle on her shoulder, a song on her lips, and maybe most important of all, a baby on her breast, a new baby. Rhiannon Giddens,
yeah.
Rhiannon Giddens of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Welcome to KDNK.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on a new baby.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, he's fabulous. He's actually on my back at the moment. So
does he now? Handy. Is he on your back on stage too?
No. Can't quite do that. I have done a couple of sound checks with him on my back, and he just goes right to sleep. So that's kind of been nice, but no, I can't bring him on stage, so it's too loud.
Now, do you put him on your lap and sing to him?
Oh, he loves music. I mean, you know, you're kind of like, oh, you know, everybody loves music, but he really just kind of focuses on it, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does, if he does anything with it, you know. We'll give him every opportunity anyway.
Right, but it'll be his choice?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Absolutely.
Sure. Now, does having a baby change the way you do the Carolina Chocolate Drops? Touring, recording, anything?
No, it just makes it a little harder. I've done this before. I've got a four-year-old.
Okay.
And so this time is actually a little bit easier. It's a little bit easier and it's a little harder because I've already done the baby thing, but I haven't had a baby and a very inquisitive four-year-old at the same time. So that's the new learning curve on this one, but it's going really great.
Well, that's great. Just like your band, Everything's Coming Up Roses. There must be an old song about that.
There probably is. Of course, all I can think of is Ethel Merman when you say that. So.
Well, when will the Carolina Chocolate Drops do an Ethel Merman tune?
Oh, well, you know, you never say never. It's not on the horizon, but you never know.
What is on the horizon for you and your band?
Well, we're just enjoying being on the road. We've got a really tight stage show and you know, the gigs have been going really well, and we're just starting to think about, you know, new material and just getting into that mode a little bit. But we've just been really enjoying the touring and just getting out there and really having a great time.
Mm-hmm. And the touring is taking you all over the country this summer or abroad also?
Yeah, we're going a little bit of both. We're going to go, we've been kind of all over the place already, and we're doing some Northeast stuff in the next week, and then we're going to Colorado for a few gigs, and we're doing some more Southern things, and then we're going overseas to a couple of countries we've never been to. We're going to Denmark and Finland for some festivals, and then a festival in England. So we're really looking forward to that. So.
Well, now, other countries surely have their versions of old-time music. Is that anything that you and the band have investigated?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere we go, you know, I'm always very interested in sort of what their traditions are. Like, when we were in Norway, I started really investigating, like, the Hardanger fiddle and their fiddling traditions they have up there. And, you know, when we're in Scotland or Ireland, the same thing there. And I am very interested in that. And you know, if anything works its way into the set, you know, that's awesome. Like, we have a couple of Canadian tunes that we do, you know. But we just like to know about the places that we're going and what their indigenous music is like. And we learn a lot that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no shortage of Celtic tunes or Celtic background with the music you play, is there?
Yeah, we've definitely pulled in from that influence. And it's got a big part of the American story is the Irish and African-American connection and how that shaped a lot of the early American music. So we're definitely interested in that.
How did you first begin becoming interested in old-time music? How did that happen for you?
Well, I've always kind of known about folk music, but more of like the 60s revival stuff. And I didn't really know much about clawhammer banjo until I got out of school. I was, you know, doing opera stuff. And I came home to North Carolina, and I discovered contra dancing, and there was a lot of old-time music being played for the dances. And I was like, what is this stuff? I love it. I love the banjo. It's amazing, you know? I mean, 'cause I heard bluegrass a lot, but that kind of style of banjo playing didn't really do much for me. And then when I heard the clawhammer, I was totally hooked. And I went and worked, singing arias at Macaroni Grill to save up money to buy my first banjo, and haven't really looked back since.
Huh. Opera trained. That's impressive. You know, some of the songs, you sure do belt it out.
Well, it's definitely been handy to learn all the breath control. That's for sure. So I've been able to use that.
Is that the most important part of it, the breath control?
Well, that's a huge part. That's one of the biggest ways not to hurt your voice singing night after night is to have correct breath control. And I've never ceased being grateful for having that training. I think it's really saved me, you know, a lot, and being able to just sort of really, like you say, belt it out night after night without having to go into the doctor. So,
Well, investigating your story, listening to your music, one name keeps popping up. That's Joe Thompson. Tell us who Joe Thompson was and how important he was to you and your band.
Well, he's kind of everything. I mean, without Joe Thompson, there really wouldn't be, you know, a Chocolate Drops. I mean, he centered us and he grounded us, and me and Dom and Justin, you know, went and played with him and just like inhaled his music. Really, we played with him on Thursday nights, and even when we were tired, dog tired, didn't want to go anywhere, we would get up and go because we knew it was too important to not do. I mean, he was 86 at that time, and we never knew how long we were going to have him, you know. So we were very lucky to be able to play with him for some years, and his style of string band music, you know, what we got from that really became the core of what the Carolina Chocolate Drops was, and the three of us became a band through going to his house, and it was a pretty special thing. You know, Justin's gone on to go back to school, and he's doing outdoor, or he's doing forestry, you know, but that he's an important part of the history, and that part we'll always have, which is pretty awesome.
Are there others out there that serve as mentors? Joe Thompson has passed now, hasn't he?
Yeah, and you know, we've definitely met a lot of people. He was like the one that we were able to visit the most. I know Dom in particular had a real strong connection with Mike Seeger. I mean, we did too, but he really, you know, felt it most keenly, and so that was really great that he was able to visit him. I've definitely taken a lot from Peggy Seeger, his sister, and learned a lot from her, and, you know, have felt a little mentored by her. So, I mean, you know, we definitely have other people along the way who have been really great. You know, Taj Mahal has been a really big supporter and has been really wonderful. We feel really lucky that we've had a lot of a great support group.
Well, with Taj Mahal being part of that equation, I guess it won't be too long before you go to Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping the band together gets to go. I got to go for 2 years. Not 2 years, I wish. I got to go for a couple of weeks to learn the akonting, learn just the beginning of a banjo ancestor called the akonting. I went to Gambia, and it was an amazing experience. I'd love to go back, and I'd love for the whole band to go. It's a hard trip, you know. We haven't really, when I started having children, it was like that kind of got taken off the table for me. But I'm hoping in the future we get to do that. We just worked with a musician from Mali named Bai Kuyate, and it was just awesome, you know. So we definitely want to explore more of that in the future.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, it's no secret that you and your band plumb the depths of Black old-time music. Are you ever going to get to the bottom of it?
I don't think there is a bottom.
Really?
You know, I really don't. Whenever you get to a certain level, you just go, oh my gosh, there's more. Like, I mean, I went all the way back to, you know, all the way over to the Gambia, but then I started discovering all the early banjo traditions that's not even talked about now, like the minstrel traditions and the even pre-minstrel and then right after that. I mean, there's just so much. You get into a level and you discover, oh, there's all this stuff over here, and then you get into one of those and I think the day we go, oh, there's no more to be done, is the day that we need to do something else, because I don't think it's ever going to be finished. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, I am happy about that. It's so complex and so deep that we just have a life work ahead of us.
Well, I suppose it's inevitable, though, that eventually some original music will creep in there. I know one song on Leaving Eden, your most recent CD, is an original. Is that the only one, Country Girl?
No, there's actually three composed songs on there. Two I wrote. One is totally original. I wrote with my sister and the beatboxer that we used to work with. And then the other one is I put some words to a tune by Etta Baker. And then Leaving Eden itself was actually written by Laurelyn Dostis North Carolina. Yeah, so, and I think that there is room for that. I think we'll always be a traditional, you know, band and when I say traditional, I mean, I think we're always going to be plumbing, like you said, the depths of the music and finding tunes to cover and finding songs to do in our own way. But I think that we also have voices that deserve to be heard. And I think, you know, one or two or even three, you know, God forbid, originals on an album is definitely not too far, you know, in the future. I think we need to start having our voice in there a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You never want to be a total original band, because I think there's a lot of people doing that and it's well covered. We want to keep doing sort of what our mission is. But I think there's definitely room for a little bit more than we have been doing, for sure. I've written a whole lot this year and last year. And, you know, I might sneak a few in there. But the bottom line is, if they're good songs and the audience resonates to them, then we'll do them. And if that's an original, then we'll do that. If the original song is not a good song and the audience doesn't like it, we're not going to do it. I mean, we're not going to do it just because it's ours. I mean, you know, so that is definitely never going to change. You know, we have a standard, and whatever it is, has got to meet that standard.
Interesting. I just wonder if the market will dictate a little bit of that. Like, you know, some skeptics, for instance, who talk about this old-time string band phenomenon and say, well, it's just a revival. I want to hear something modern and original. Do you ever hear that? Is that something you hear?
Well, I mean, I see there's a lot of people doing that already. I mean, the Mumford & Sons, they write their own stuff, and the Avid Brothers and the Lumineers and all that Americana. I mean, it's really, a lot of that is you know, influenced by this whole revival thing. And I think that some of the old-time tunes that we've done them in a very modern, you know, putting beatbox on them and just sort of really updating them. And I think that's challenging. You know, I think it's in some ways, like, it's a little easier to write a whole new song you know, because that's automatically going to be modern. But I think taking an old song and refreshing it and making it new for people, I think that's a challenge, and that's something that we really revel in, and people seem to be really responding well to it. One of our biggest one of the things that people are really asking about these days is a piece we do called, I call it Mouth Music. It's a Scottish, an old Scottish, you know, a cappella piece that we put bass, drum, cello, and bones to, but we play it in a very, like, you know, it's definitely influenced by sort of our modern sensibilities, and man, people love it, you know. So it's like, we definitely feel like that's one of our niches. That's what we do, mm-hmm. you know, and if people, you know, we're finding the people who like that, and so they're coming to our show. I haven't really heard people complaining about the lack of original material, because I think there's lots of shows for them to go to, but we'll keep doing what we do, and you know, we'll definitely put some more original stuff in there. I think we've got a couple of really great songs that are coming up, but you know, that's what we do.
Huh. One of the things that characterizes your band as a phenomenon, I think, is bridging generations. I have a 20-year-old son, and he came to me, I don't know, a year ago, maybe it was just after Genuine Negro Jigs, but anyway, he said, hey, have you heard of the Chocolate Drops? And I said, yes, I love those guys. And he goes, I do too. And, you know, there's two different generations reveling in this revival that you guys are a big part of. Do you see a lot of age ranges at your shows?
Yeah, and that's something I'm really proud of. You know, I love the fact that we hear from grandmothers who are like, I turned on my grandson to your music, you know, and then vice versa. We hear from, you know, young people who are like, I played, you know, I gave your CD to my dad or my granddad, and they loved it. And it's just, I love that. You know, we see people coming out to the show as like two, three generations, you know, in one family coming to the same show. And it's just fabulous. I really am proud of that part of our music, because I think that's one of the things we do, is we tap into that American music that was like before there was kids music, or, you know, young music or old music. I mean, it just was the music that people listen to. And I think people feel that. And so they, you know, it's something they can all come out to. I mean, sure, sometimes we play like a theater or a club where it's like, you know, most, you know, it restricts the age range a little bit, but you know, a lot of times it's just, you see that range, and it's awesome. We love that.
Well, I have to say that I guess Genuine Negro Jig was the one that certainly put you on the radar. Indeed, it's the one that you won a Grammy for. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've seen it before with new bands that release records. That first one catches everybody, and everyone is so wowed by it that the second one inevitably pales in comparison. But that didn't happen with you guys. Leaving Eden, which followed Negro Jig, is just as interesting and diverse and arresting as the first one. I wonder, actually, it's not your first CD, but as anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Right. How do you account for that? I guess part of it might be the presence of Buddy Miller.
Well, I mean, thanks for saying that. I think that there's a couple of different things that went into that. I mean, because that's the issue in this business, is the sophomore CD. I mean, because for all intents and purposes, Genuine Negro Jig was our first album, and we had released albums before that. But that was the first one, like with the real a producer from like sort of the outside world, and it was on a major label, and so for a lot of people that was their first exposure to us. And I think that when the second one came, there'd been some changes in the band, you know. So Justin, who's the original fiddler, had decided to go back to school, and we wanted to keep the band going, and he gave us his blessing, and we found, you know, Hubby Jenkins from New York and Adam Matta, who's a beatboxer, and it just shook everything up, you know. So in some ways it was kind of like starting over with all of their experience that we already had. So I think that was part of it. And then also part of it, of course, is Buddy. He did a great job, and it was a different, you know, aesthetic than Joe Henry. And so it was just like, I think all of those things together, you know, made for an album that we're really proud of. I mean, it definitely had a different kind of effect than Genuine Eagles did, because, as you said, it was the second one for a lot of people. But I think all of that together kind of, you know, made it a little bit easier to stay fresh, you know?
Looking at things from the outside in, it seems like you're doing everything right. Does it feel that way to you? I mean, I'm sure you must feel blessed, but it seems like everything's happening the way it should. Is that the way it feels to you?
You know, it does. Like kind of in the overall grand scheme of things, there's definitely hard days, and there's definitely days I'm like, wow, you know, this is a really hard job, especially with two kids on the road, you know, because I take them with me. Mm-hmm. But I think that as long as we stay keyed into the mission, things go well. You know what I mean? It's like the mission for us is like the idea of being in a black string band is bigger than each member, which is why I think we've been able to continue even with personnel changes. You know, it's like anybody who comes in believes in it. And then, you know, for whatever reason, they leave the road, life is too hard, they want to go back to school. But like, it's something bigger than us. And I think if you have something like that to believe in and to do as a musician, then I don't know if you can go wrong. I mean, you know, you can make mistakes in your professional life. And we have definitely been very lucky to have an excellent team around us that we've kept, you know, for this whole time. And they've really directed us very well. But we've also strongly, you know, followed our conscience. And, like, you know, it's not like a what would Joe do, but it's kind of like, you know, how does this serve the mission? Are we getting out to more people? Are people enjoying the shows? Are they learning something? You know, and if all of that's going great and it serves that, then we do it. And it seems to be growing organically from that. And so that, you know, if that makes sense. I mean, so that's kind of how things have been working for us. And we are very happy and blessed to, you know, as you said, to be doing it. But I think as long as we stay focused.
That mission sounds important. And you know, that resonates with me because I work at a community radio station, and it's the same kind of thing for us. Something bigger than us that we're all dedicated to kind of makes things flow.
Yeah. Because it's a kind of a world of very shallow stuff right now. I mean, there's deep stuff out there, but it's harder to get to. You have to kind of dig a little bit. And community is more important than ever just because of the fractured way we live our lives now with the TVs and sort of being in our own little houses. And, you know, so any way to build community, I think, is only going to be a good thing because as humans, we have to have it, you know. So I think people respond to that.
Rhiannon Giddens, I want to thank you so much for what you do and how you do it, and also for joining us here on KD&K. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for the wonderful conversation.
Let's listen to a short tune from the Carolina Chocolate Drop's second CD, Leaving Eden. Here's a short instrumental called Mahala, which reminds me a lot of mento music from the Caribbean. Well, that's going to do it for today's Express Yourself. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the news coming up on KD&K. And remember to go out there and express yourself.